Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
You're listening to World Weekly with me, Jonathan Derbyshire. On the show this week, we'll be looking at tensions on trade between the US, the EU and China. The Trump administration has extended the EU's exemption from new US steel and aluminium tariffs until June the 1st. Meanwhile, the American president is sending a high-level delegation to Beijing for talks to stave off a trade war between the world's two largest economies. Why is Mr. Trump threatening to impose these tariffs on the EU? What can the EU do to get out of them? And what is the aim of US trade policy towards China? Joining me on the line from Washington is Sean Donnan, the FT's global trade editor. And on the line from Berlin, Guy Chazan, the FT's Berlin bureau chief. Thanks, Sean and Guy, for joining me. Sean, let me start with you. The EU remains the US's largest trading partner. Transatlantic trade was worth more than $700 billion last year. So what is the Trump administration up to?
Well, they're trying to create leverage and address what Donald Trump has labeled sort of historical injustices in the trade world. He looks across the Atlantic. Previous administrations have seen a healthy relationship, a grouping of allies with a long and rich history. Donald Trump looks across the Atlantic and he sees a $151 billion trade deficit. He thinks that the European Union is having one over on the U.S. and that this has contributed to declines in the U.S. manufacturing sector, and as he said the other day at a rally in Michigan, that the EU was set up in some way to take advantage of the United States economically. So in his mind, he is going out there in the world, and he's doing the same thing with China, and he's going out there in the world, and he's trying to fix these wrongs that he sees in his mind. And the big wrong that he sees is the deficit, and he wants to repair that. And steel, you know, the steel industry, this is a core constituency for him. It was a core constituency in 2016. And they've been cheering him along, and all they want to see is their market protected, their domestic market protected from imports, and Europe is part of that picture to them.
You mentioned China, but let's stick with transatlantic trade for the moment. Sean, you wrote this week that Trump administration officials have likened their trade push to the way the US has handled North Korea. The thinking seems to be that tougher sanctions brought Pyongyang to the negotiating table and to the cusp of a historic deal on the Korean Peninsula, and that Mr. Trump is trying to do the same on trade with China, the EU, and also with the US's NAFTA partners, Canada and Mexico. Guy, how is this strategy going down in European capitals, not least Berlin?
Well, I think people are just horrified by it. I mean, the thing is that the European capitals are happy to talk about trade, but they don't want to do it, as they put it, with a gun to their head. This is now a big controversy raging in Europe as to how to deal with Donald Trump's tactics. And so far, they're hewing to this line that they will never grant concessions to secure a permanent exemption from the kind of tariffs that Mr. Trump wants to impose, because they consider those to be illegal in any case. So it puts them in a real quandary, in a sense. Especially the Germans, I think, would be quite keen to negotiate, but they can't do it when they feel they're being blackmailed by this threat of tariffs on steel and aluminium. So he's really got them in a cleft stick, in a way.
Do you think there is the glimmer of an opening for the US on the relationship? You said that the Germans might be more willing to negotiate than some of their European partners, but Brussels, of course, has said that it will not, and I think the quote was, negotiate under threat. And the EU Trade Commissioner Cecilia Malmström has taken a particularly hard line on this. So, Guy, can the EU maintain a united front, and for how long?
Well, that's the key thing. I mean, I was just reading something in the German press this morning, actually, which said they really have to, because if they don't, that's really the end of the EU as a trading power. It must maintain unity. It's absolutely essential. But it was definitely the case last week before Angela Merkel went off to Washington to have talks with Mr. Trump. There was definitely a sense that the Germans, in their sort of pre-meeting briefings, they were conveying the message that Germany would be open to a sort of new negotiation on tariffs with the US, obviously through the EU. But they said it has to be really tariffs on all industrial goods, not just cars. They're obviously terrified that the US is going to insist on reducing import tariffs on US cars, and also maybe, who knows, you know, raising tariffs on German imported cars. That's a very, very sensitive issue for them, obviously. So they want to broaden the debate to all industrial goods. And, you know, they were saying, you've got to see this holistically. They said that on textiles, for example, the US imposes a 32% import tariff. On shoes, it's 48%. So everything should be seen as a sort of as part of a big package, really. They said that when you look at industrial goods altogether, the average tariff is 1.4% in the EU and 1.6% in the US. So it's actually higher in the US. So that was their approach. But it's still early days. I mean, it's unclear as to whether those arguments will have any purchase in the US.
Sean, as Guy just said, the analogy drawn by the Trump administration between these trade negotiations and negotiations with the regime in North Korea have not gone down particularly well. The Trump administration, by extending the exemption, has given itself another 30 days to seek a deal with the EU. But this is a high-risk strategy. How likely do you think a deal is?
Well, I don't think a deal is likely in the next 30 days, but what we may end up with is an agreement to kind of talk, to hash out a bigger deal. And the question is whether that's going to be enough to satisfy Donald Trump. I mean, the context for all of this is that the Obama administration had launched these enormous trade talks with the EU, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and those have been kind of put in the deep freeze since the Trump administration came in. And the Trump administration looks across the Atlantic and says, look, this is a major trading partner. We should have some kind of trade deal with them, but we want a different kind of trade deal from what the Obama administration wants. We want something much more transactional. And that's where this question of the auto tariffs that Guy was talking about comes in. I mean, that is a huge portion of the transatlantic trade. From the Trump administration's perspective, it is also a huge portion of the trade deficit. There are a lot more European cars coming to the U.S. than there are U.S. cars going to Europe. The problem with this is that the Obama administration spent years negotiating with the EU and got nowhere, really. And it became a huge politically toxic thing in Europe. And it was just very clear that this was not going to get done. The Trump administration looks at that and says, maybe we can do something much more practical, focused on industrial tariffs. These are something that they're relatively low if you look across the band in terms of the trade. But this gets at some into some important areas like cars. And I think, you know, one of the proposals that they've tabled is, let's do this industrial goods deal. But then the Europeans have started poking at that and asking, well, what do you mean by that? And the Trump administration has come back very quickly and said, well, we want something that will help close the deficit. Now, that means in kind of trade speak that you get an unbalanced deal. When trade negotiators sit down across from each other, there's a whole lot of horse trading that goes on. Guy mentioned textiles and shoes, for example. You know, the shoes is really, a lot of it is Nike versus Adidas, if you will. It's how you protect your local champions and your local industries. And so you start trading these things. And the question for the European officials is whether they're going to end up with a deal that is just going to become politically toxic for them again at home, which is why I don't think that you get anywhere fast. There's one other thing that the Trump administration is holding out there, which is important to keep in mind. And that is, they have said, if there are not going to be tariffs, then there need to be, quote, quotas. And what they are using there is a 1980s model, something the Reagan administration used, called voluntary export restraints. And what the Reagan administration did is it went out to countries like Japan and said, you need to voluntarily agree to restrain your exports of steel or cars to a certain limit, a quota, and in return for that, we won't slap tariffs on you. And it used this as its real leverage in trade negotiations. Now, since then, we've had the creation of the WTO, the World Trade Organization, and these things are illegal now under global trade rules. So the EU is pushing back against this idea of the quotas. In its mind, it's defending the system, the global trading system and multilateral trading rules. But the Trump administration really doesn't care about that. It's got a much more practical view of these things, a much more transactional view, and it's willing to test the system. So that's another tension in these talks right now. So Argentina, Australia, and Brazil have reached agreements in principle with the Trump administration to avoid these steel and aluminum tariffs. And we're learning that the Argentinian deal and the Brazilian deal appear to cap their exports of steel at roughly 100% of their average exports over the last 3 years. So it's not a hugely damaging agreement if you're a Brazilian steelmaker. You're agreeing to keep going where you are. You may lose some upside, but clearly you've still got the market that you had beforehand. The question for the EU politically on this side is going to become, are we willing to accept something like that with a kind of much more benign quota thing, or are we going to reject it in the name of systemic purity? There's so many tensions at play here that it's really unlikely any of it's going to get resolved in the next 30 days.
Guy, as Sean was alluding to just then, some EU officials believe that any agreement with the US, whether it's on tariffs or on quotas or on so-called voluntary export restraints, would be the thin end of the wedge and a threat to the global trading system. Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, was in Washington, D.C. last week. How comfortable do you think she would be about being maneuvered into the position of being the defender of the global trading system that was actually developed by the US after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989?
Well, I mean, after Trump was elected in 2016, there was a lot of commentary in the press saying that Angela Merkel was now the last liberal standing. She was effectively the last surviving bastion of liberal Western values. And as such, she really almost took on the mantle of the sort of leader of the free world. And really, since then, that's exactly what she's been doing. At every available opportunity, she has been expounding the virtues of multilateralism and the world liberal order and sort of a free trade, rules-based trade and so on. So I think in a way, you know, Germany is really holding out for that because so much of its success as an economy is built on the success of its exports. And it really, really needs to enforce those rules of free trade. Otherwise, its entire economic model is under threat. So I think in a way, the principle is extremely important to her. But on the other hand, I mean, we're talking about German cars. You know, if there is any risk to the German auto industry through the imposition of quotas or tariffs, then of course she would do anything to avert that. You know, this is the lifeblood of the German economy. It's the absolute mainstay of the economy. And I think in a way, she embodies this quandary that European officials, European leaders now face. What to do with this US president who, as Sean said, has this entirely transactional view of the world. Obviously, whenever anyone has said to her, you're the last liberal standing, she just laughs that away. But it is actually very interesting that she was very much in two minds about whether to stand again for a fourth term before the election last year. And in the end, she said that part of the reason why she decided to stand again was because the world had become so much more unstable. Brexit, the Trump election victory. She saw the foundations of the world order that she had somehow been part of were just crumbling. And I think she really felt that she had almost like a responsibility as a senior politician in Europe to stand again. But it's a difficult dilemma for them.
Sean, how is opinion on trade policy arrayed within the Trump administration? Would it be fair to say, for example, that some members of the administration, those responsible for setting trade policy, are more sympathetic to the predicament of Germany that Guy has just described than others? When one thinks, for example, you have on the one hand Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, and on the other hand Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, who arguably have slightly, at least different emphases in the way they approach trade policy.
Yeah, it's complicated, like everything in the Trump administration. You know, I spent a lot of time going in and out of the White House and various other departments here in Washington. And over the past year, or almost 16 months, I've started to look at trade policy as not a singular thing in the Trump administration. Anytime you hear something, an idea on trade, you really need to triangulate and find out what the different camps are thinking there. So it's clear that there isn't a single view on these things. There are some people who are much more defensive or much more willing to embrace the existing system, and then there are others who clearly would be very happy destroying the system, and they sit in the same meetings with the president. So, I mean, there's an incredible diversity of views, and we saw that in the lead-up to the imposition of these steel tariffs earlier this year. These tariffs, these very specific tariffs, led to the resignation of Gary Cohn, the former Goldman Sachs executive who was heading up the National Economic Council. He'd spent more than a year trying to fight off these tariffs and stop them from going into place, but finally, Trump just sided with the economic nationalists and out went one of the so-called globalists in the administration. I think there's still some globalists left in this administration, but I think what's become clear is that there's a lot more agreement on the pragmatic approach to trade. They feel a lot less sentimental about the global trading system than anyone in the EU does. And they look at what Angela Merkel is trying to do in terms of positioning herself as the last liberal standing, and they find that interesting. They also find it slightly jarring to them because they look, again, at the trade deficit with Germany and with the EU and say, well, yeah, of course, she's just defending her position and she's winning right now. And they also see, like Angela Merkel, Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, is out there positioning himself as a great defender of the multilateral trading system. So there's a lot of cynicism here in Washington about these other leaders who are positioning themselves as the defenders of the system and how to deal with them. There's a bigger question here in Washington, though, in terms of how you tackle what they see as a bigger problem, and that is China. And for that, a lot of people in the administration argue you need allies, and your biggest allies are going to be the EU and people like Angela Merkel. You need them to be on your side as you take on China, which everyone has problems with in the world when it comes to trade. And that's where things, again, get messier. But there's certainly no unified, unitary view here in Washington on how to deal with trade.
Guy, I'll ask you in a moment about the EU attitude towards China on trade. But Sean, you reported this week that Donald Trump is sending what you described as the Magnificent Seven of US trade policy to Beijing for talks to stave off a trade war between the world's two largest economies. Now, the FT's chief economics commentator Martin Wolf wrote in a column this week, and he's just spent a few days in Beijing talking to very senior members of the regime there, that Beijing finds US goals on trade to be entirely opaque. And they're asking themselves whether Mr. Trump's aim is simply to foment conflict. So what is the Trump administration up to on trade with China, and what is its end game?
Well, its end game is completely unclear, and the Chinese are absolutely right. It's confusing. And those of us who sit here in Washington and look at it at a daily basis see a real tension within the administration on how to deal with this. There's broad agreement in Washington, not only within the Trump administration, but across political parties and up on Capitol Hill and in Congress, that China is a problem and that it needs to be addressed and that it has been flouting the trade rules for too long and that that has hurt the U.S. economy, that it has taken away manufacturing jobs from states like Ohio and Pennsylvania and Michigan, and that something needs to be done. And that there's also an existential fight going on as well about the future and the 21st century economy. And that's China's position in artificial intelligence and robotics and how it's trying to position itself in those places as part of what Xi Jinping has called the Made in China 2025 plan. The reason we've got seven people going to negotiate with the Chinese out of Washington speaks to the diverse views within the administration. And originally, this was conceived as a trip where Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, was going to go and sit down with his counterpart, and they were going to quietly talk some things out. Then pretty soon, there was a view that actually four people should go, that you should get Robert Lighthizer, the U.S. Trade Representative, who's a longstanding China hawk, that you should also have Larry Kudlow, who replaced Gary Cohn at the head of the National Economic Council, and is someone who's just very keen on a deal to calm the markets, and that also you should have Peter Navarro, who's the ultimate China hawk in this administration. He's the author of a book called Death by China, former academic economist who's really made a career out of bashing China. They've just kept adding to these ranks, and that makes a deal even more unlikely, and it's going to make what the Chinese see, I suspect, even more incoherent when they look across the table. These are seven people with very different takes on what to do to address the trade problems with China.
Guy, presumably Berlin will be watching the outcome of these US-Chinese negotiations with some interest. Does Germany share the US's view that China is a problem, as Sean put it, on trade?
Absolutely. I mean, in a way, this is the irony of this whole debate, is that because there's now this enormous row between the EU and the US, it's sort of somewhat overshadowed the fact that they have a common interest in doing something about China. I mean, a lot of the arguments that you're hearing in the US about Chinese trade practices and its attitude to intellectual property and so on, you hear all the time in Germany too. Germany is actually increasingly paranoid about China. One of the main reasons for that is the fact that so many Chinese companies are now coming in and buying German Mittelstand firms. And Mittelstand are the sort of small and medium-sized enterprises, which are really the backbone of the German economy, the so-called hidden champions. And they've been doing this in a very strategic way, coming in, literally buying companies that have the kind of technology that they need for this 2025 program that Sean was mentioning. So there's increasing paranoia about that, but there's also increasing dissatisfaction with the way German investors are treated in China, the way they're forced into these joint ventures, which the Germans increasingly see as just a way for the Chinese to get hold of these companies' intellectual property, and they just end up being a vehicle for technology transfers from Germany to China. So there is increasing angst about that. The Germans are becoming increasingly outspoken in their criticism of China. And yet that has now obviously been completely overshadowed by the huge row they've got with their big ally, the US. I mean, I think Macron himself, Emmanuel Macron, actually said, you know, that he wanted to work with the US on addressing overcapacity in the global steel market. But we can only do that once this threat of import tariffs on steel and aluminium are put to one side definitively. So they do have a common interest. They just don't understand why America is targeting them when they should all be joining forces to work against China.
This story clearly has a long way to run, and that's it for this week. My thanks to Sean Donnan and Guy Chazan. World Weekly is produced by Fiona Simon. Until next week, goodbye.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.